Well, Jim said that if we just record the class tonight, he's just going to replay it on Sunday. I thought, no, he's not going to get off that easy. Because what my purpose is in this segment of our study is just to get a feel for some of the major components of Messianic prophecies, so that when we get to the New Testament and we start looking at some of these things in detail, we'll have at least an inkling of the kind of thought processes that might have been entertained by the people, not only in the days of the prophet, but also especially in the first century. And I'm trying to put these things together in a historical sequence. Obviously, there's question marks. You start looking at chronologies and you start looking at commentaries, and they'll say, well, it could have been here, it could have been there, and, you know, maybe this, maybe that. So, that being said, we're not going to hold anybody's feet to the fire on the exact dates of some of these events. But we can get pretty close. And so, historically, as we think about where we left off last week and David in particular, we're looking at roughly 1,000 years before the time of Christ. And these particular passages are key to the whole concept of not only one coming from the lineage of David, but especially God's rule through his throne, which is identified in David's day as David's throne. And that is that's particularly important if you start talking to a premillennialist. We went over some of these things in our study of Daniel. And at the end of Daniel, when we went through several lessons on premillennialism, but these are... this is a particularly important facet of this whole picture. So I don't want us to miss that. Now, in the course of David's time, particularly David, there were a number of psalms that he assumed author. Some are pretty obvious, and some are, you know, suspect. And there are other psalms. You know, David wasn't the only one that wrote psalms. There were other people who did. Solomon did, and some of the priests, and probably other kings. So psalms is a collection of it's really kind of an eclectic collection of various psalms that were written. But we know that the Psalms are inspired, so this is information that has come from God. In the middle part of that little segment here on page 21, where I say the place of David in God's plan, the examples of the Messianic Psalms that I've listed there are certainly not all-inclusive, nor is the typical list. There are other Psalms that have a verse or some verses in them that are, you know, definitely, or that definitely pertain to events in the life of Christ that are fulfilled, and we'll look at some of those. But this is just one of the lists that I picked up from somebody. Can't remember who. I've read so many different things, and it was again, it's not intended to be comprehensive, but it's got a fair number of them in there. And the reason that we'll look at the others in more detail later on, the reason I just picked out these is because I think there's some pretty obvious elements in these Psalms that will help us to understand what the people would think and what their reaction might be. So, the first one I want us to look at tonight is Psalm 2. Now, without going into a detailed exegesis of this text, I just want us to kind of go over the big picture and pick out two or three things that you think the people would be thinking when they heard this psalm, and in terms of the big picture, as far as God's rule, their position with respect to God, and what the future might hold. So let's read, and we'll start, and I'll let you read, and just kind of have your antenna up as we read through here, and in your mind, put your finger on a couple of few things here and there that we want to make sure that we don't overlook. So let's start up here, I guess, Betty. You want to read? Well, just go ahead and read all 12 verses, because we've got enough to go around tonight. Okay, again, I don't want us to get bogged down in an exegesis of the text, but what are some things that, again, if you were a Jew living in David's day, or you were one who read this later on, you know, over the course of the next 300-400 years, this would be read, this would be sung. What are some particular points that you believe would strike the Jewish mind that came from this psalm? All right, that's got to be the first one that jumps out at you. Anointed. We've talked about the significance of the word anointed. I hand you to the word study, what that meant to the people. And so it played a predominant role in their thought process. Okay, go ahead. Anything else?
Verse 7 says, "You've got me."
Okay, before we get down there, in terms of just, again, all the whole picture from the text, what would be the image of God and the relationship of nations, peoples, etc.? What's the image of that whole group?
Huh? Their image or our image?
I'm sorry?
Their image.
Yeah, no, theirs. I mean, when they read this or sang it. Or
God's going to bring judgment on the people because he's the one sitting in heaven in control.
All right, so it's a matter of an adversarial picture, isn't it? God and the people that are against God. And I think that thread runs throughout the whole psalm. And the reason I want us to get to thinking like that is because when we get to the first century and we look at the accumulation of the history of the Jewish people for 1,000 years, we're going to see this common thread that runs all the way through their whole history for that whole, you know, that period of time. Is, hey, there's God and there's the people that are against God. And then what Paul just said, God is in control. God is the sovereign, And those who are in opposition to him are going to be on the receiving end of his wrath. Just, you know, put that in your memory bank, because we're going to see this over and over and over and over. And so it's no surprise then when we get to the first century and we see that people have got this little, you know, preconceived idea based upon 1,000 years of history, both secular and sacred. Okay. And again, his supremacy. He laughs. He's the one that's in control. And then another thing. Verse 6 here. And I'm sorry. What did you say, Nancy, before I interrupted you? Well, okay. All right. I've begotten thee. All right. Which is a statement of position. Again, going all the way back to Abraham. Isaac was his only begotten. Begotten in the sense of the one in the preeminent position. So there's a little more subtle picture here of one who is in a preeminent position as ordained by God. Lori?
I was in 6, you know, I set my holy king, I set my king upon, you know, the holy Zion, so that was Zion.
Yes. Zion. That again is going to be a recurring image. Zion, the place of God's rule. Right. And we're going to see that reiterated numerous times. And it's also, again, when we get to the first century, then we're going to understand why they're so intent upon having a king in Zion. So it goes back a long ways. You know, this is about 1,000 years before that. Okay. All right. So, is there anything else in there, in the big picture, that you think is noteworthy here? I mean, it's all important, but you know where I'm going. Yeah, and this really ties in with what Paul said. Again, it's the idea of the adversarial relationship, God against his enemies, and he's the one that's going to come out on the winning side of that conflict. So there's quite a few verses or several different places in here where you can get that picture. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to Psalm 8. Rather than reading the whole psalm here, let's look at verses 3 through 3 through 9. Nancy, you want to read that, please?
The English Standard Version. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the seas. O Lord, O Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth.
What have we just read there that, again, pertains to the subject? His rule, yes, his rule, and I mean, yes, there's a lot more, but and of course, you immediately recognize a portion of this text that is quoted by the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 2 that is applied to Jesus. But that if you were, you know, until you got to that point, you didn't know. You didn't know that that applied to Jesus. So looking at it from the other side of the cross, God's in control. God's rule. All right? Okay, Psalm 16. Let's take a look at that. Let's see. How much of that do we want to look at? Verse 10 is the verse, of course. Rick, go ahead and read verses 10 and 11, if you would, please.
For thou wilt not abandon my soul to Sheol, neither wilt thou allow thy Holy One to undergo decay. Thou wilt make known to me a path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. In thy right hand there are pleasures forever.
Yeah, they would not understand how this applies to the resurrection of Christ. However, what would they get from this? That's germane to the subject. Paul? Well, okay, I'm thinking a broader spectrum. I'm thinking again about God's rule and control over the realm of the dead. That God has that power. Now, if you think back over the course of their history up to this point, we know, for example, Abraham. Abraham was fully persuaded. Now, we don't learn this until we get to Hebrews 11, but Abraham was fully persuaded that if he sacrificed Isaac, God would raise him from the dead. David was, you know, fully persuaded that he would see his son again. He believed in the resurrection. So there was a belief in God's power to raise the dead. So I see that in this verse. Now, who it applies to, that's pure speculation at this point. We don't learn about it till Acts chapter 2. But this would be reinforcing the fact that God's rule extends beyond the physical realm. That God had the power to function in the realm of the dead, which is where Sheol, the Sheol was the realm of the dead, the grave, the realm of the dead. Paul? Right.
And I don't see the idea of personally. I don't see the idea of him being God of the dead, over the dead too, resurrection. But showing him that no matter what, Jerusalem or Israel is going to stand no matter what happens to
them. Well, except in verse 10, thou will not abandon my soul to Sheol, nor will allow thy Holy One to undergo decay. That is the realm of the dead. Now,
well, I realize that,
yeah.
But how did they look at it? What you're saying?
All I'm saying is, they must have at least acknowledged that God had power over that realm.
Well, we know that some of them
did. Right. Yeah. And I think you're right. I think when we get to the New Testament and we see, well, even before we get to the New Testament, some of the literature in the Qumran that we're going to look at indicates that, yes, they were looking for, well, they were looking for one to be raised from the dead. And then, of course, when you get to Matthew 16 and other passages, then that also reinforces that idea that they for lack of a better explanation, they would say, well, I guess, this is one of the prophets that God has raised from the dead. So, yes, they had that built into their brain, their little memory bank. Now, Psalm 22, I was told by what I read somewhere that the Jews never, at least, I don't know if never is good, but 99.9% of the time, whatever, did not look at this as a messianic psalm. But, right. But let's just look at a few things that might at least have given them some picture in their mind of of God's power and a couple of other elements that I'd like to bring to our attention. So let's skip on down to verse 19 and read verse 19 through the end of the chapter. Who's next? Sue, would you like to read that?
But you, O Lord, do not be far from me. O my strength, hasten to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth and from the horns of the wild oxen. You have answered me. I will declare your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly. I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him. And fear him, all you offspring of Israel. For he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried to him, he heard. My praise shall be of you in the great assembly. I will pay my vows before those who fear him. The poor shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him will praise the Lord. Let the Lord live forever. All the ends of the world shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth shall eat and worship. All those who go down to the dust shall bow before him. Even he cannot keep himself alive. A posterity shall serve him. It will be recounted of the Lord to the next generation. They will come and declare his righteousness to a people who will be born, that he has done this.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much because I'll be stealing Jim's thunder. But one of the things that has been brought up before when we studied the psalm is that one of the ways in which a particular psalm or elements of a particular psalm would be cited is to quote the first verse. And so when that verse was quoted, the mind started, the wheel started turning. And they would think about the various things that were in that psalm. And so when there are passages, and of course there's several passages, several verses in this psalm that are applicable to what we know of happened with regard to Christ, we need to remember that there is the broader perspective of the psalm of what the person is going to think in terms of the subject matter of it. And then when an inspired person makes an application of a particular element of that psalm, Sometimes, not always, but sometimes we need to make sure that we fit that into the context of the whole psalm. And the reason I say there are exceptions to that, because there are elements of prophecies that either one verse is all that applies to a particular future event, or sometimes there are two fulfillments. There's a recent, that is fairly recent, fulfillment that would apply. Now, for example, in the case of Solomon, when talked about 2 Samuel chapter 12, there are certain elements of that that would apply to Solomon that would not apply to Christ, but yet those things that do apply to Christ are cited by the apostle, for example, Peter in Acts chapter 3. So you have to kind of, you know, look at these things from various vantage points to make, you know, to get all of the right, I guess, get the right perception. In this particular case, there are, you know, there's the broad picture of the whole psalm that Jesus starts at when he quotes the first verse, and then there are specifics that we would pick out as we would go through it, and Jim will take care of that, and we'll do it later if when we get around to it. Right now, from what Sue just read, what image of God would be reinforced in the minds of the people from this psalm?
A deliverer.
Yes, that's a key word. Deliverance. Deliverance for the one that was oppressed. Okay, deliverance for the one that was being persecuted. Deliverance for the one that looked like a worm, a dog. And all these band of evildoers that are, again, it's almost the theme of the book of Revelation. Yeah. There's God's side and there's Satan's side, and God wins. I mean, that's what Revelation is about. Okay? We just studied Revelation. 5 seconds or less. So, that's what we have here. Any other particular notes of importance that you want to bring out there? There's a whole bunch, but... Okay.
You know, when they say being delivered, they're thinking physically delivered from whatever the oppression was at that time. And even throughout time, it's in various oppressions.
And I think verse 28 reinforces that. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. So again, that's building that thought in their mind. God is in control. God's in control over all the nations. So if a nation comes along, or a series of nations, or a confederation of nations comes along and is arrayed against those that perceive themselves to be God's people, then they've already got this. God's going to take care of this. God's going to, you know, he's going to whip those people. He's going to deliver us. He's going to raise up some, give us some help. Well, he did a number of times over the course of their history. So it's not so far-fetched as to think that they would still be in that mode of thinking in the first century. See? And we're just barely even touching the hem of the garment as we look at this. But I think you already know that we've got a pretty good start of the building blocks. All right, let's look at the 40th Psalm. verses 6 and 7 in particular. I was going to try to get through most of these tonight. So, again, because I don't want us to get bogged down with looking at the the trees without seeing the forest. Sacrifice, this verses 6 and 7 of Psalm 40, sacrifice an offering thou wouldst not, thou hast not desired, my ears thou hast opened, burnt offering and sin offering thou hast not required. Then I said, behold, I am come, in the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do thy will, O God, the law is within my heart. I have proclaimed glad tidings and of righteousness in the great congregations. Behold, I will not restrain my lips, O Lord, thou knowest. So here is one who is a servant of God that has come to do his will. Now, I know that we don't find out who that is specifically in reference to these verses until we get to Hebrews chapter 10. But again, just the idea that God's in control and that he can use people. He can use individuals. He can use those that are on his side to accomplish his will and those who are willing to do his will. In the 41st Psalm, verse 9, of course, is the one that is cited in the New Testament. I don't know that there's one there that's going to add to our understanding of what we're talking about at this point. Let's do look at chapter 45, at Psalm 45. An unknown author, several, it says, of course, a masculine of the sons of Korah. Some have suggested that this was penned by Joram to Athaliah, which would have put it in about 850 B.C. Verses 6 and 7 are the key verses. Cameron, you want to read those, please?
Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Scepter of your kingdom is the scepter of uprightness. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with oil of gladness beyond your companions.
Observation? Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, the throne. The throne of God. I mentioned that. Go ahead. Yes. Yes. That scepter would not depart from Judah. Genesis 49:10. So this reinforces that. And then, as was pointed about God's anointing. So, well, I don't want to sound like a broken record. All right. All right, let's look at chapter of Psalm 68. I would suggest to you that you take the time to read the entirety of these, but let's jump on down to verse 15. Well, yeah, let's read 15 through 20. 15 through 20. This.
Why leap ye high hill? This is the hill which God desireth to dwell in. Yea, the Lord will dwell in it forever.
And were you, are you, let's see, are we on, are you reading Psalm 68?
Yes.
Okay. All right. It just reads a lot different from the New American, so that's okay. You know, I'm the odd man out here. Okay. Yeah, and verse 20.
He that is of God, our God, is God of salvation, and unto God the Lord belongeth the issues of death.
So the victorious God leading thousands and thousands, just like he did at Sinai, again, his sovereign rule, and a God of deliverance is emphasized in those verses. Dennis?
My question is, you're saying that while David is going through all this, thinking that the Lord has forsaken him and he needs to feel that the Lord is
No, I didn't. No, I'm saying that these Psalms are painting a picture that the Jew would be building an image of God in his mind over the course of time. If that last Psalm was written in 850, that would be 150 years after the time of David. But these songs were sung for 1,000 years in their worship services. So over the course of those years, these pictures in their mind of God and his relationship to people and his power and his rule would be reinforced and firmly established in their mind. So that's the main point that I'm making. Okay, let's look at Psalm, let's see, which one? I'm about to run out of time tonight. Let's go to, let's see. Well, let me just skip through a couple of verses here in Psalm 89. I will sing of the loving kindness of the Lord forever to all generations and make known thy faithfulness with my mouth. So the faithfulness of God, the dependability of God. Verse 4, I will establish your seed forever and build up your throne to all generations. So this is another one of those throne passages. And the perpetuity of the throne, the image of the perpetuity of the throne, and the permanency of God's rule in that domain. Verse 11, the heavens are thine, the earth is thine, the world is, and all that it contains, thou hast founded them, and he created them. Verse 12, righteousness and justice are the foundation of thy throne. Verse 14, verse 27, I shall make them in my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth, my loving kindness, I will keep him forever, and my covenant shall be confirmed to him. So I will establish his descendants forever, and his throne as the days of heaven. So the throne, the rule, the establishment of one on his throne, who's identified as his firstborn, his verse 24, his name. And in my name, his horn will be exalted. The horn is the power, the rule. Verse 35, once I have sworn my holiness, I will not lie to David. His descendants shall endure forever. His throne is the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon and the witness in the sky of the faithful. It goes all the way back to the promise that God made to David, 2 Samuel 12. and his descendants, and you know, raising Deuteronomy 18, raising up a prophet like Moses, and all of those passages that we looked at in previous discussions. And so this covenant that God made with David is now reaffirmed in this psalm. And again, you look at the long-range picture, the idea of descendants forever and his throne in the days of heaven and establishing his throne forever. Like I said, it would be very instructive, I think, to take a concordance and look at all the throne passages. There's going to be a whole bunch of them. But it would be... We're looking at a few already, so... And I can see right now I'm not going to get through this tonight. Yeah, I know. I get... look at Psalm 102, verse 12. But thou, O Lord, dost abide forever, and thy name to all generations. And thou wilt arise and have compassion on Zion. Verse 16, for the Lord has built up Zion. Verse 18, this will be written for the generations to come, that the people yet to be created may praise the Lord. So there's a clear future dimension to this. But it's still tied in to the idea of God's rule and his throne and Zion and the other things that I brought out in the sermon that I preached on that chapter. You might go back and review some of your notes there. 109, that's just one verse, basically. But 110 is a biggie. If you don't remember more than two or three of the Psalms that are messianic, make sure you mark down 110 and entrench that in your memory bank. It's quoted more than any others. And the interesting thing about this is that even the scribes... in Jesus' day, looked at this as a messianic psalm. In Mark 12, 35, 36, and 37 is one of the encounters that Jesus had with them, and the reference is made there that, you know, they saw this as a messianic psalm. No, they did not want to connect the dots. They did not. And it's short. It's only seven verses. The language of the text will certainly ring a bell with you. The Lord has said to my Lord, sit on my right hand till I make thine enemies the footstool of thy feet. One of the most often quoted passages from the Psalms in the New Testament. Maybe the most quoted. The Lord will stretch forth thy strong scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of thy enemies. See, we've got Genesis 49, we've got the rule of God, we've got the throne of God. The people will volunteer freely in the day of thy power, in thy holy array from the womb of dawn. Thy youth are to thee as the dew. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. Thou art a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. So now we've got the Melchizedek priesthood of Christ. You know, I told you I jumped over Genesis 15 on purpose, but we weren't going to, we were not going to ignore it. Okay. And we won't, and we'll... We'll say more about this as we go on. The Lord is at thy right hand, and he will shatter kings in the day of his wrath, and he will judge among the nations, and he will fill them with corpses, and he will shatter the chief men over a broad country, and he will drink from the brook by the wayside. Therefore, he will lift up his head. Does that sound like anything we've already read tonight? about 15 times. Yes, God is in control. God's ruling. God is going to prevail. And one who is his Lord is going to be sitting at his right hand. He will say to one who is Lord that he is to sit at his right hand till his enemies are made the footstool of his feet. And you remember how Jesus backed the Jews into a corner with this passage? Okay, David said that, so who was he talking about? Oh, his son. Oh, wait a minute. If he's his son, how could he be his Lord? Oh, I guess maybe that means that he pre-existed David. And that's when they balked. They saw without any hesitation what the implication of that line of reasoning was, and then they closed their mouths. They would not open their mouth and say, yes, that's right, because that's the only way that statement could be true is if the Lord of David preexisted him, which means that he had to be deity. And boy, they were not about to admit that. They would eat crow before they did that. So that's where we're going to have to stop tonight. Yes. Look back over these and others of the that are listed here. And refresh your memory and the discussion that we've had, because my guess is you're gonna think of these in a little different way than you have before as you try to connect the dots with the big picture.